When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hi, I'm Jeremy Stahl. I'm Slate's jurisprudence editor. Ordinarily, I edit our courts and legal coverage from the comfort of my home office in Los Angeles, but for the next month and a half, I will be locked in a lower Manhattan courtroom with the rest of the press, a jury of 12 New Yorkers, Justice Juan Merchan, prosecutors, Trump's defense team, and the former president himself as history unfolds. I've temporarily moved myself and my family from Los Angeles to New York to cover this case firsthand, like I have done in other cases, including the Paul Manafort case, the Roger Stone criminal trial, and Donald Trump's first impeachment. I'm hoping that my background knowledge of the many, many criminal travails of our former president can offer something to you, Slate's listener. Over the next several weeks, you'll be hearing from me on Amicus, Slate's legal podcast, and in articles on Slate.com. From the jury selection to the opening arguments to the witness testimony and cross-examination and the prosecution's case and the defense's case and ultimately to a final verdict. We will be providing you wall-to-wall coverage throughout the entirety of the trial as it unfolds from the courtroom. There's no way I'd be able to do it without the support of Slate Plus. So if you're not already a subscriber, please join today by clicking try free at the top of the Amicus show page on Apple Podcasts or visit slate.com/amicusplus to get access wherever you listen. Thank you so, so much.
The following podcast contains explicit language.
You know, there are people that are going to tell you that it's just a few bad apples. If you look at the video, you can't say this whole group, this has nothing to do with white people. It's just a few bad apples. What do you say to that?
To that, I say that if that's your actual belief, then you're living with your head in the sand. I used to live in New York City and would occasionally go to Hoboken, New Jersey, St. Patrick's Day Parade. And there were so many young white men there. Vomiting in the streets, urinating in the streets, getting in fist fights in the streets. I've seen it myself.
Hey, all. Welcome to Represent. I'm your host, Aisha Harris. And on today's episode, we're jumping straight on into the deep dive conversation with a mover and shaker in the industry. This time around, we've got former Gawker editor turned TV writer, Cord Jefferson, who has recently written for the dearly departed The Nightly Show and season 2 of Master of None. But first, I want to give you all a heads up that on next week's episode, we're going to be discussing the very controversial award season contender. Yes, that's right. Nate Parker's Birth of a Nation. Now, if you've paid any attention to the news swirling around the film over the past couple of months, you know that there's a divide amongst potential audiences. There are those who say that despite Parker's murky past and unsatisfying response to it in the present day, the story of Nat Turner deserves to be seen in this way. And there are others, like writer Roxane Gay, who have publicly declared that they cannot bring themselves to watch the film in light of what we've learned about its creator. So I'd like to hear from you. Are you planning to see The Birth of a Nation in theaters? If so, why? Or if not, why not? No judgment here. Just leave us a voice memo at slaterepresent@gmail.com or leave us a message at 646-580-1748. We'll also put that info in the show notes. Your thoughts might get shared on next week's episode, and we definitely want to hear from you, so give us a shout. And now, on to my interview with Cord, who recently joined me in the studio. One of the things we talked about during our conversation was how his transition from journalism to writing comedy for the screen isn't quite as huge of a leap as it might initially seem.
You know, I would look into the biographies of James Baldwin, who's a hero of mine, and Joan Didion, who's a hero of mine, and sort of look at what these people did with their lives. And I would realize that, you know, what it meant to be a writer to them was very broad. They'd go write a piece of journalism, then they'd go write a novel, and then they'd go write a screenplay, and then they'd, like, you know, James Baldwin would follow Martin Luther King around the road and, like, write about his travels with MLK, right? So what it meant to be a writer for them was huge. It encompassed everything.
In that spirit, Cord started off writing personal essays and eventually found his way to Gawker. The rest of our conversation led to a very candid discussion about his time there at Gawker, and also what it was like working with Larry Wilmore, and later, his love for the 90s sitcom Rock. Thank you so much for joining me today, Cord.
Thank you for having me.
Now, I have to ask you, like, what are your thoughts, just briefly, on, like, the demise of Gawker?
On Gawker. It makes me very, very sad. I think that it was a special place. You know, I think that, you know, when I was a kid, you know, when you're thinking of like fun kid games, like the pirate always seemed like a fun one to me, you know, and I think that Gawker was probably the closest I'll ever come to working on a pirate ship, you know, that came back to bite it in the ass a lot of the time. But at the end of the day, I also believe that Gawker was an important outlet and was doing important work. And so that was working there was a tightrope walk every day, you know, coming in and you'd have these really high highs where you're like, you'd break a story like Rob Ford, you know, or Manti Te'o and be like, oh my God, we're doing incredible work here, work that other news outlets are too scared to do, you know? And it felt really good. But then some days you'd come in and you'd be like, oh, I don't like what I did here. I think that one of the clearest ones of those for me was one time there as a it was a Miss Teen Rhode Island, I believe. We got a tip that a Miss Teen Rhode Island, a teenage beauty contestant, was in a porno. That we got a tip that she did porno, and so that it, and if she was in porno, then that would disqualify her from being a beauty pageant contestant. And it normally didn't fall to me, that kind of like quick tip and blog, but for whatever reason that day everybody was busy, and so the editor-in-chief asked me if I'd be willing to write that piece, and so I did. It was assigned to me, and so I wrote this piece. I went and checked to see if it was this woman, and it was in fact her, and I wrote up the piece, and it was like, you know, instantly big, and she instantly lost her title. I remember leaving work that day feeling bad. It just felt like punching down. It didn't feel important. It didn't feel like we had improved the world at all. It was true. It was certainly true. This was a young girl who was in a porno movie, who was also a beauty contestant. But I don't know. I didn't feel like I had actually contributed to the world in that way at all. I felt like I hurt a person.
Right. Did you have any hesitations when it was assigned to you?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay.
I was sort of, I had hesitations that I sort of didn't, I had hesitations that I didn't, fight for probably as strongly as I could have. I did try a couple things for instance, one of my kind of feeble attempts at making things better was that I initially tried to like not link to the movie. I tried to sort of just say like, you know, I'm not going to help people like find this movie, but you know, they asked me to put it in. My bosses asked me to put in the link because, you know, their side of it was that this is true. And the link to the video is more evidence that this is true. And, you know, like not linking to it doesn't really mitigate the damage. It just sort of makes it less, provides less evidence for the fact that this is true, you know? And I was like, well, I know it's true. I called the Beauty Queen organization that runs the things and I got confirmation that that's her. But, you know, they asked me to put the link in. So that kind of thing, I did put up some protestation, but it wasn't, you know, it wasn't really strong. It wasn't rigorous. And I think that, so that was an instance where like, I still think about that one. I still think about that as something that I regret doing and that I regret being a part of.
I mean, it's also just you think about the famous women who in recent years have had like, granted it's porn, it's not quite the same, but like sexting, text messages and that sort of thing, and whether it's right for a journalist who's reporting on this to actually link to those things. I mean, I have to say that's like I feel like that's a line you shouldn't cross. And I think that is obviously that same sort of idea is sort of what brought Gawker down with the whole Hulk Hogan thing.
Yeah, I think that's the sort of what that story that I just told points to, and what the what ultimately was Gawker's downfall, right, is the gray area of newsworthiness and the gray area of which direction you're punching. So are you punching up or are you punching down? And when Gawker first started out as this, like, you know, small little red media blog, it was always punching up, you know, because everybody was bigger than it. So you could go after a lot of people as furiously as you wanted to because everybody was bigger than you and that you were powerless. Mm-hmm. But as Gawker started to get bigger and bigger and bigger and started getting name check in the New York Times and on CNN and was sort of like really started to run with the big boys, assessing what was punching up and what was punching down was more difficult.
Right.
And so that day that I wrote about that beauty queen, I felt like I wasn't using the tool for good. I was using the tool for, I won't say evil, but I was using the tool to kind of dismantle somebody who wasn't deserving of that. That said, those days were few and far between, you know. I felt proud and excited to work at Gawker far more often than I ever felt bad about working at Gawker. To this day, I think it was the definitely the best job in journalism I've ever had.
So from Gawker, your story is sort of interesting in that you, as I understand it, you just sort of got a phone call to be like, hey, yeah, are you interested in writing for TV? Like, how did, was this someone you knew or a friend of a friend? Was that
no?
That
this
sort
was
of thing?
I did this thing at Gawker actually. I wrote this short satirical piece about it was like the culture of white violence.
Mm-hmm.
I think in 2013 there was a riot in Huntington Beach at a surf competition. So it was all these white kids at a surf competition who proceeded to destroy Huntington Beach and like get in fights in the street, and they were drunk and they were bashing open building windows and stealing stuff, and it was tipping over porta potties, and you know, just what happens at a riot. And so I wrote this quick satirical piece about, you know, this culture of white violence has got to stop, essentially turning on its head everything that people say about, you know, black kids, if black kids are ever involved in kind of.
I remember that piece. I really liked that one.
Thank you.
Yeah.
And so I wrote that. And then the next day, Chris Hayes reached out to me and asked me if I would do a satirical, just basically do the article but perform it on his show, and we'd do a segment basically sort of bashing the white community for letting the white youth run amok. And so, you know, the same thing that you'd see on Bill O'Reilly if there's ever like a black riot, right?
Right.
And so we went on and I talked about the culture of white violence and how this has to stop, and like white parents have lost control of their kids and all this stuff. And it like instantly blew up, like in a way that I wasn't expecting at all. And so about 3 weeks after that, a guy reached out to me, a guy named Jermaine Johnson, who's with this company called Three Arts, and asked me if I'd ever consider writing for television. He said he'd think he thought I would be good at it. So I went and met him for coffee in LA, and we kicked around some ideas. And he said he saw that piece and that he liked. And then he went and read the piece, and then read some other stuff that I'd written, and said that he thinks that I should write a script. So we kicked around ideas for a spec script. But it wasn't a comedy, actually. I started writing a drama spec script, a 1 hour, which I think that he was disappointed by, because I think that he wanted – I think that he maybe expected a comedy script. But I was like, no, that's I want to write a drama first. So I wrote a drama.
What was the drama about?
It was called – the drama was called Forgive Me, Father. Loosely, it's a working title, we'll say. And it's – I always felt like my father's a Vietnam veteran, and veteran stories have always been very interesting to me. And I still feel that we, society in general, but Hollywood in particular, does a disservice to veterans by not telling the stories enough, which I find them, you know, as important as war is in people's lives, and as often as America is at war, we talk about it surprisingly little in popular culture.
Yeah.
And we especially talk about what happens to people when they come back from war and how people live their lives post that.
I could think of quite a few examples off the top of my head, although all of them are centered around white guys. And your dad is
yeah,
black,
my dad's black, and yeah. I just felt like – I mean, maybe I'm wrong. I just feel like –
I just think of like Platoon, Born on the 4th of July.
Oh, yeah. Oh, no, absolutely. But those – I think that as far as Vietnam movies go, absolutely. But I'm talking about like our current
– True. Oh, okay.
I'm talking about Iraq and Afghanistan.
Okay, yes.
Absolutely.
That,
there was an definitely. Entire crop of Vietnam movies, and Deer Hunter and all that. Yeah.
Yeah.
A lot of great stuff.
But I'm talking about like our current wars. You know, my
oh for sure, yeah.
You know, the majority of my adult life, America has been at war. You know, and there's very little popular culture to reflect that.
Yeah.
And seeing that, you know, seeing how you know it. My dad was, I won't say luckier, but maybe it is luck. But my dad was luckier than a lot of people. You know, my father wasn't homeless. My father, you know, wasn't suicidal ever. But I did see the way that it impacted his life and affected his life forever. You know, and he's still to this day he's affected by that, and he'll say openly that he was affected by war in a deep way, and it changed him forever. And mm-hmm. He once told me that the thing that that breaks his heart about his life the most is that I will never know the man he was before he went to war. He said, I'll only know the man that came back from war. And that is – and he said that is the most heartbreaking thing that he's ever known. Yeah. So I think that fast forward to modern America, we don't really give those stories to veterans. So
yeah.
I was interested in writing a veteran story but not writing, you know, the same veteran story that this like vet comes back with PTSD and he's an alcoholic. So I wrote a veteran story that was not a veteran. He was a military clergy, a Catholic priest who went over and spent 3 years in Iraq and Afghanistan and saw some really heavy things and was dealing with the fact that he, you know, one of the Ten Commandments is thou shalt not kill. But he spent 3 years convincing people to go out and like kill people and die every day for maybe a war that he didn't necessarily believe in. So it's not just it's not a soldier. It's a military clergy who comes back sort of like haunted by a lot of things that happened over there and kind of follows his crisis of faith post-war. Thank you. I thought it was, you know, for the first ever script that I wrote, I look back at it and there are some things that I really hate and some things that make me cringe. But for the most part, the structure of it I liked, and I felt like there was something there, you know. But I didn't do it in earnest. I kind of was very lackadaisical about it. So like I said, we met in July 2013. I sent him a draft. I sent my manager a draft in January 2014. And a week later, out of the blue, a guy named Mike O'Malley wrote to me and said, hey, I'm starting a writer's room next week. Would you be interested in joining? I've read some of your stuff and I think you'd be good at it. So I called Jermaine, my manager, who wasn't my manager at the time. And I was like, hey, man, I know we don't have a business relationship, but I just got offered a job to write for television. Would you be willing to give me some advice about that? What do you think that I should do? And he was like, this never happens. It's a once in a lifetime opportunity. Nobody just cold calls you and asks you to come write for TV.
Yeah.
He was like, people work for years and years and years to do that and they still don't get that job. So he was like, take the job and we'll figure out what to do afterward. Your hardest job. The first job is the hardest to get and everything after that kind of comes easier.
And this was for Survivor's Remorse.
For Survivor's Remorse on Starz. Mm-hmm. So I called my boss, John Cook at Gawker, and I said, hey, I know that I hate to do this last minute, but it was like they offered me the job on Saturday for Monday. The Monday was the start. So they sent me the official offer on Saturday, and they wanted me to start Monday. So I called John Cook on Sunday, and I said, hey, man, I know I feel awful doing this, but I want to take this job writing for TV. And he was very gracious about it. He knew that I wouldn't have been leaving if it hadn't have been for something so vastly different.
And how was it different? Because obviously writing for a magazine or a newspaper is very different from writing. It's a collaborative experience when you're in a writer's room.
Yeah, absolutely. I would say it's not entirely different. I think that if you are able to tell a story – I believe that storytelling is storytelling is storytelling. If you're able to sit around a campfire and tell an interesting story and keep people interested, then you could probably be a decent journalist. Mm-hmm. And then if you can sort of write a piece of journalism and keep people interested from point A to point B, then you could write a movie also. And if you could write a movie, you write TV. And, you know, I just feel like some people are should be storytellers. And if you can tell a story one way, you can probably tell a story another way. Mm. There's just different ways to go about telling that story. So it wasn't vastly different. It was but it was different. And you're right, it was far more collaborative. You know, we sat around a room. I think there was eight of us on that show.
What was the breakdown? Because Survivor's Remorse, if for the listeners who might not have heard of it or haven't seen it, it's a show with the predominantly black cast.
Yeah,
it's
produced by LeBron James.
LeBron James. And Tichina Arnold is one of the stars. It centers around an athlete. And so that's like a show with a predominantly black cast. And what was the breakdown like in the writers?
There was actually a lot of black writers, majority black writers.
The creator, though, is
creator's
white.
Mike O'Malley's white. His co-EP was a guy named Victor Levin. He was a white man. Mm-hmm. Sasha Penn was white. But then the rest of us, four more of us, and we were all black. One black woman also. So gender breakdown isn't great. But race breakdown is far better than you're going to see in most Hollywood writers' rooms.
Yeah.
And Mike was very purposeful about that. And that was one of the things that attracted me to him was that, you know, he said, I'm not going to be a white guy who writes a show about all black people with a room full of white guys.
Thank you.
Yeah. He was very purposeful about that. And he reached out. And, you know, I feel incredibly grateful to have met him and to have worked with him. And he literally, you know, he literally changed the course of my life. There's not a lot of people you can say that about. And he literally did that. He said, hey, would you want to try this new thing?
And how long were you on the show for the first season?
Incredibly short, 13 weeks.
Okay.
It was a 13 week. So yeah. Because the first season order was 6 episodes, half hour episodes. And so we were in and out of there. It was 13 weeks, which was one of the reasons. That was initially one of the things that I initially was freaked out about when I called Jermaine and made that first call and told him I got this job opportunity is because he I said, you know, I liked what I was doing. I was a gawker and I liked what I was doing. I was good at it. And so to take that leap for a 13-week job with no guarantee beyond that was actually pretty terrifying.
Yeah,
it's one thing if you know, if it's one thing, you know, if I were an accountant and I hated my job and I felt like I was going to die every day just because I was so miserable, then it's like, okay, no brainer, I'll take this leap. But I enjoyed what I was doing, and there was no guarantee that I could come back and do it if I did this thing and it crashed and burned.
Yeah.
So, but I did it anyway, and it was 13 weeks, and then was probably the worst summer of my life following those 13 weeks just because there was no – I couldn't get a job anywhere. It was I call it the – I did the couch and water bottle tour where I was going to every studio in L.A. I was going to ABC, NBC, HBO, CBS. I was just – like every production company and every studio in L.A. I went to basically and met with people and chatted. And by that time, I had also written a comedy script, which was helpful. Jermaine said that after I'd written the drama, I should write a comedy also because there's a lot – it might be easier to get into comedy rooms than it would be to get into drama rooms right off the bat. So
for a black person, yeah.
Yeah.
From the people I've spoken with, that tends to be a lot easier to get into those rooms.
Absolutely, especially if it's my second job. You know? Nobody's really going to sort of – I don't think take the risk to hire me especially after my first job was a comedy show, you know?
Yeah.
So I wrote a comedy script and I just went and met a lot of people. And it was humbling. It was great though, you know? I was dancing for my dinner again and just going out and meeting new people and explaining who I was and explaining what I was interested in. A lot of the stuff that I didn't have to do, you know? I wasn't like a super famous celebrity journalist or anything. I'm not Malcolm Gladwell, but I was, you know, people were writing to me and asking me if I would do freelance stuff. It wasn't instead of me going out and sending out pitch letters and stuff. So having to start at square one and explain to everybody who I was and what I was interested in and the work that I've done in the past was, I think, good. It sort of forced me to reevaluate what I was doing and forced me to reassess what I was actually interested in and think about what I wanted to do with my career in television in a good way. But it eventually started to wear on me after I spent all summer basically eating into my savings slowly. And then my apartment building got sold. I'll never forget that they sold my apartment building to just one of the worst landlords I've ever met in my life, just an awful man who was slowly trying to erode everybody's willingness to tolerate him so that eventually everybody would leave and just he could finally just jack up the rates on all the apartments. So that was happening and I was just – one day I was leaving my apartment and I was miserable and I had been to meetings all week and I was tired and there was no job in sight. And I went to look at this new apartment down the street from me. It was sort of in my price range and I was in the neighborhood that I wanted to live in and I was so excited to get there and I got there.
And I was like sweating because I had raced over there. And I walked into the apartment and so excited and ready to fill out this paperwork. And there was like 25 people already there.
Oh.
I was like, oh.
Yeah, that's...
I'm never going to get this apartment.
Yeah.
Whoever's going to get this apartment is already here. They've probably been here already for an hour. And so I left just... in agony. I was miserable. I was on the verge of tears. And I went home and I sort of banged out this long email to Jermaine, who by that time was my manager. And I was like, hey, man, I just need you to be honest with me. Maybe this was a pipe dream. It was a fun pipe dream if it was. I've had a good time. I don't regret it at all. But I need you to be honest with me and tell me if, you know, this has come to an end and that I'm not going to get a job in television again. Because if that's the case, then I need to go back and like figure out what I'm going to do and like get a new job. Because by that time, I'd also been offered like three other journalism jobs that I've turned down to continue pursuing TV. So I said, you know, I just feel like if I keep doing this and I'm going to A, eat up all my savings, but B, not going to be able to get a job in journalism because I'll have been gone for so long. And then so it'll be something that just isn't there anymore. And so he wrote me back the next day and was like, listen, I understand where you're coming from, but I promise you this is just sort of the way things are right now, just because nobody really knows you and we're getting your name out there. I promise you we're incredibly close to something. I'm sure of it. Lo and behold, I got an interview with a guy named Rory Albanese who was going to he was flying out the next day. I was the first interview that he took. He was flying out the next day to start hiring writers for a show called The Nightly Show.
With
Larry Wilmore. And yeah. So I met him, and I was the first writer he met, and he said, I didn't know this at the time, but he called Larry, he said, after he met me. And he said, I think we found our first writer, but I want you to meet him. And so 3 days later, I went and met Larry on the set of Black-ish and hung out with him there and had lunch with him and then went and hung out on the set for a little bit and watched him direct an episode. And then I found out 3 weeks later that I got the job. And so I moved to New York in December 2014.
Yeah.
And
you helped launch the show, essentially.
Yeah. Our first day was December 3rd, about 7 weeks before we actually launched the show. So we started writing test episodes and writing sketches and stuff 7 weeks before we started, which was not a lot of time now that I've worked on a daily TV show, 7 weeks of preparation is not a lot of time.
Yeah, there's so much work that goes into it.
It's insane.
Yeah.
It's insane. And so, Nightly Show was an incredible experience for me because having worked for only 13 weeks on a TV show, it was really sort of baptism by fire. You know, I was forced to write every day. I was forced to create every day. I was forced to pitch every day. You know, there's no time to sit around feeling sorry for yourself or like wondering whether or not you can write this or whether or not you're a good writer. And I feel like I became a much, much better television writer during that time just because I was forced to write every day and forced to write TV every day.
Did you guys feel any outside pressure or put any pressure on yourselves as being like, this is a big deal because it was Larry Wilmore. It was a black person with a late night show. And I actually had Larry on the show a few weeks ago. He was great. But it does seem like there is so much pressure. And I'm wondering if that like translated at all into the writers room, like if that's anything you ever discussed.
Well, no, I think that it was nothing that we ever discussed. But, you know, the pressure was there. I don't know if it was necessarily because Larry's black. I think that is an unspoken thing that certainly it was in the back of my mind, I will say at least. I don't know if it was in the back of everybody's mind. I certainly don't know if it was in the back of Larry's mind because he seemed very sort of like calm and collected the entire process. But the thing that was scary to me was the shoes we were filling, you know, and the shoes that
Stephen Colbert's
shoes and the shoes that came before us, which were Jon Stewart's shoes. So. Mm-hmm. Coming onto that network in this beloved time slot where these sort of like icons, American, truly American comedic icons existed for years and years and years, that was scary for me. We were taking over for this guy that everybody loved and we were going to try to do something totally different. It's pressure to perform no matter what. But, you know, there was those things. There was like Larry's black, you know. He has a staff of, you know, the head writer's a black woman. You know, there's a lot of black people in the staff. You know, the diversity of the staff
was not representative of what you're going to see in other writers' rooms, especially the late night writers' rooms. You know, we were trying something different in many ways, and so I think that there is that unspoken tension that comes from, and that unspoken kind of pressure that comes from trying something new and try something vastly different. Yeah,
and I want to jump back a little bit to your piece for Medium about writing about race and getting sort of stuck in that rut and getting tired of having to prove your humanity and prove the humanity of Black people. And I'm not sure how long you were on the show. When did you leave the show?
I left April.
Okay, so you were around
for about 17 months.
Right, so you were around for, you know, the Charleston shootings, mm-hmm. Sandra Bland. How did that translate into, like, you have that feeling when you're writing about it every day as a journalist, but, like, within the writer's room, sort of, how did that translate? And did that wear on you in a similar way as it did when you were on the journalism beat?
It didn't wear on me in a similar way because I feel like there was so many more tools at my disposal and so many different ways that we could talk about these things. TV is such a dynamic medium. You know, I remember I believe it was for Ferguson when the Justice Department report came out on the Ferguson police and just, you know, how they were constantly basically using the Black community as a way to fund their coffers mm-hmm. and were just stopping people constantly and harassing Black people constantly to help fund the police department. You know, that was a grim piece of work, you know, reading that, it was heartbreaking. And you saw how it devastated people's lives. But, you know, I remember that night that came out, we sort of did a breakdown of what the report said. And then, I'll never forget this, we put fake taillights on Larry's desk. And in the middle of him talking about what was happening in Ferguson, we sent out a writer at the time to play this cop.
You can't just stop me in the middle of my show and start giving me fines for stuff.
Yes, I can. I definitely can, especially if you have a broken taillight.
Well, my desk doesn't have taillights, so I don't...
Tell that to the broken taillight on your desk. Hey,
you know, we were saying something. It was satirical. It was funny. It was smart. And we were talking about that report in a way that I would have never been able to talk about that report if I were writing about it for Gawker. You know, we were able to, you know, take this incredibly sad thing and, you know, there's only so much outrage I could muster. I think what I was writing about in that Medium piece, you know, is A, the psychological toll it takes on you, but also, you know, what else can I say? Like, you know, I should say, like, this is awful. Here's what happened in this report of what the police are doing, and this is awful. We should be disgusted by this. If we're at all disgusted by the degradation of the Black community, everybody should be disgusted by this. And I didn't know how many more ways I could say that. I felt like I said it over and over and over again. I felt like I was saying it constantly.
Gets so tired.
Yeah, it's exactly. Because what can you say, you know? Mm-hmm. But you say, like, when you go to a workplace like that and you can say, okay, let's put taillights on Larry's desk. Let's bring out a cop and, like, have him smash the taillight. Let's have him, like, write all these ridiculous tickets for Larry that comparable to the ridiculous tickets they're writing to Black people in Ferguson. All these dynamic ways that you can make your point in a way that you couldn't do it if you were just writing for a newspaper, writing for a magazine, or writing for a website, you know?
Yeah. I'd like to shift over because you are now working on Master of None, correct?
I was, yeah.
You were.
We finished writing that season.
Oh, awesome. The show was very critically praised and people loved it, but there were some, like, criticisms, like with all shows. Granted, this has to do more with casting than it does with actually writing, but, like, there were criticisms that Aziz Ansari's character, all of his girlfriends, or most of them, were white, and there were thoughts about why that is and why interracial relationships always have to be with a white person. One of the people is a white person. And I'm curious as to whether you ever discussed those things, addressing them in the second season, whether that was anything that ever even came up, or if it was just purely like a, we need to build on these characters and that sort of motivation within the writer's room.
There's a very tight leash on what I can say about season two. I will say that what I can say, Aziz is a very thoughtful guy.
Yeah.
He is a very smart guy from what I saw working with him over the course of several months is that he certainly thinks about these issues deeply
mm-hmm.
And he thinks about these criticisms deeply. And I will say that I would suggest that people tune into season two.
Cool. That's a very diplomatic answer. I'm definitely going to tune in.
All right.
I'm slightly fangirling out because I love that show so much. I also loved his speech that technically he didn't do the speech. Alan Yang did.
Alan did, his
co-creator.
Yeah.
But I thought that was just a great point that he made.
They're both very thoughtful guys. They're both, I think, that a real testament to what television can be and what you can do. People saying, you know, nobody's going to tune in and people aren't really going to like television if it's not white characters and this stuff won't sell. It's like, it's bullshit, you know? That is a show that, it has 100% rating on Rotten Tomatoes, you know? It's incredibly hard to do and it's kind of universally acclaimed. And I think that those guys have proven that you don't need to have straight white men and straight white women falling in love in order to get people to watch comedies. You know, I think that you can have people doing different things and talking about different things and talking about these sort of serious issues to them and these deeply personal issues. And you can have intimate portrayals of people who aren't white people and people are going to like it. You know, those are universal themes.
And I know you've only been in a couple of writers' rooms, but I think we all know that the breakdown is also often still very heavily white. But it's like it seems like that show would have like a way more diverse.
There was only one white man in that writer's room.
Huh,
everybody else was either women or women of color or men of color.
Cool.
There was only one white male.
I love that.
Entire time.
It's great.
Yeah, and that's I've been lucky enough to be in rooms and see sort of I'm trying to think. Every writer this is crazy to say. I mean, I've only been in three writers' rooms, but all three have been significantly. They've sort of had a significant presence of people of color and women.
Yeah,
it's been a thing that has been. I think that I think that the criticisms are helping. I think that people are understanding. You know, even if we want to look at it in the most cynical way possible, which is that it's good for business. You know, I think people are finally starting to understand that. You know, having storylines that black people want to watch and that South Asian people want to watch and that Asian people want to watch, you know, the having those kinds of storylines and those kinds of representation are going to be good for business because people are hungry for that. You know, a lot of Americans are hungry for that. A lot of people are looking at television, looking at movies and seeing that they're being left out in the cold as far as having their stories told.
You recently wrote for the New York Times a really loving recommendation for the TV sitcom Rock.
Yeah.
And I'm going to out myself here and say that I vaguely remember watching it as a kid.
Yeah.
But I think I was too, like, I just caught it in reruns and it wasn't rerun very often.
No, it's not rerun at all anymore.
Yeah.
A friend made fun of me because I wrote a letter of recommendation about something you can't find.
I know. I mean, I think you can find, like, bootleg videos on YouTube, but that's, like, the extent of it.
Yeah.
And that show stars Charles S. Dutton, and you talk about in the piece about, you make comparisons to The Cosby Show and how Rock was way more, like, the characters were embedded with more realism. Like, it didn't limit its sort of realism, quote-unquote, to very special episodes. It was just kind of baked into their DNA, like, the lead female character, it's revealed at some point that she was sexually assaulted.
Yeah, at the end of the first season.
Right. So it was very real. And I guess my question, which is not, it doesn't really have anything to do with that aspect of it, but I'm curious, if you could choose to have written on any 90s TV sitcom, which would it have been?
Any 90s TV sitcom?
About black people. Yeah,
I would say that the cynical part of me will say The Fresh Prince of Bel-Air.
I
love that show a lot. But that show is also a rerun all the time, and I would be getting residuals to this day, and I would have a lot of money.
Yes.
But I also will say that show tempered its commercial appeal with, like, very serious. Good issues, you know. Do you remember the episode where his dad leaves?
I ain't need him then and I don't need him now.
Will.
Now, you know what, Uncle Phil? I'm gonna get through college without him. I'm gonna get a great job without him. I'm gonna marry me a beautiful honey and I'm gonna have me a whole bunch of kids. I'm gonna be a better father than he ever was. And I sure as hell don't need him for that because ain't a damn thing he could ever teach me about how to love my kids.
I
How come you don't want me, man?
That was the moment.
It's devastating.
That might be Will Smith's best performance.
Yeah.
Hands down.
But, if I'm not being a cynic, if I'm like really going to go for it, I would say Rock. But Rock was on 3 seasons, and I'd be looking for a new job. I'd still be living large if I wrote on Fresh Prince of Bel-Air.
Yes, you would. I mean, look at Andy Barowitz.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Yeah.
I believe Larry Wilmore wrote on Fresh Prince also.
I think he did. He did lots of those 90s sitcoms.
Yeah.
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 So my final question to you, which I ask all of my guests, is when is the last time you watched something that you were not directly involved in, it was not written or created by you, that you felt represented by? Like you could see yourself in the show or in that character or...
This is difficult. What do I feel represented by? I got it.
Mm-hmm.
I got it. So did you watch the OJ documentary?
Yes.
Made in America?
Yes.
So I'm obsessed with that.
Yeah.
I'm obsessed with it. It's my,
you
one of
be.
My, yeah, one of my, the guy who made it is this guy named Ezra Edelman. You should have him on. He's one of my friends. He's a great dude.
Oh.
Super smart.
Can you hook us up?
Yeah, probably. I'll try. Yeah.
All right.
But so OJ Made in America, you just realize like OJ is like a damaged person in a very real way. But the thing that I walked away with and the thing that I've talked to my friends about since was that thing that like I'm not black, I'm OJ.
Yeah,
this famous quote.
Yeah.
Like, as crazy as I think that OJ is and is as sort of like dark as I think that a place that comes from, like, I remember thinking, like, I understood that. Like, I understand the desire to be seen as unique and not like a part of a monolithic black community and being like, no, I'm me.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I'm a human being. I'm different. And like, look at me as a human being. Like, don't look at me as like this monolithic thing that you look at the black community as. Like, I understand that impulse. And I think that impulse led OJ to do crazy shit. Like, say, you know, do you remember the anecdote where he's like, where they were like, oh, look at that table of niggers. Like, OJ's with the niggers.
Oh,
and
yeah.
And OJ's like, no, it's great. Like, I'm not the nigger. I'm OJ, you know, like,
yeah.
To cause him to do like insane stuff like that. And just like to sort of like ingratiate himself to white people in such a deep way that sort of you could tell he was trying to be that kind of weird,
Chameleon. Yes.
That's kind of like chameleon quality that he was looking for.
Yeah.
That is insane. But I also understand, like, I just want to be me. Like, I just want to be a human being. I want to be seen as a human being the way that I want to be seen as a unique human being the way white people are seen as unique human beings. I totally get that. I totally got that. And that was a thing that was like, damn, like, that is something that I'm feeling like for a moment, like, oh man, I have something in common with OJ. Like, what the fuck is wrong with me that I have something in common with OJ?
That's the thing about OJ, though. He's so friggin' complex.
Yeah.
And what's great about that documentary is that it gets at all the ways in which he is so friggin' complex.
Yeah.
And it's not just, for lack of a better analogy, black or white, like, or metaphor or whatever. It's, yeah, I can see that, too. I understand that quote. And obviously, I think you're saying you don't like agree. That's not something you would ever say.
Oh no, it's not something I'd ever say. I'm black. I'm just saying that, like, that motivation to be like, man, I just want to be a man. Like,
exactly.
I just want to be a human being.
It's
just look at me as a human being.
Yeah. Well, this was an amazing chat. I really appreciate you coming on the show.
Thank you so much. No, thank you so much for having me. I hope I answered everything.
Yeah, I love talking about your very unusual trajectory towards becoming a TV writer.
It's weird, yeah.
Looking forward to whatever you do next.
Thank you so much.
And I'm excited for Master of None.
April 2017.
Oh, that seems so long from now.
It is. It is. But it'll be worth it.
Awesome. Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, that's a wrap for today. So great to have Cord on for such a candid conversation, and I cannot wait to see how Master of None goes down in just a few months. You can find links to the things we touched on in the show notes, and as always, you can subscribe to us on iTunes, Megaphone, Stitcher, or any other place you find your podcasts. And speaking of iTunes, I'd just like to say thank you to everyone who's been listening so far. It's been a great journey to have you all send your messages and your thoughts and your critiques. And we just found out recently that we made it into new and newsworthy under the iTunes heading. And so it's really great to see ourselves up there. And we're just looking forward to bringing more great stuff for you as we continue along. Represent is produced by the lovely, awesome Verilyn Williams. The executive producer of Slate Podcast is Steve Lichtig. Andy Bowers is chief content officer of Panoply. And you can follow us on Facebook and Twitter at Slate Represent. And the music is performed by the sweet San Francisco funk soul band Midtown Social. Until next time.